Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week we'll hear from former Israeli intelligence officer Avi Melamed, who now runs the nonpartisan Inside the Middle East, and he tells us that October 7th could have been much worse. It's frightening. Lorene and I then get into President Trump's trip to the Middle East, and we have very differing views about that. That and so much more. And don't forget, you can get your third opinion wherever you download your podcasts. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to us. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW in the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Lorene in Tampa.
And we have a full show today. We have a special guest who is an expert from the Israeli government on terrorism and the Arab world. And one of the things he'll tell us is that October 7th could have been even worse. Hard to believe. We'll talk about that in just a little bit when we get to him. But we have a lot of stuff that is going on right now.
We do. And, you know, I just want to say this is, we are going to talk about October 7th. I mentioned this before we started the show, that, you know, there's a piece in the Newsweek magazine, and this is actually an older piece. It's from December of 2023, shortly after October 7th, and it was titled, "I Saw the Children Hamas Beheaded with My Own Eyes, Shame on Queen Rania." Now, Queen Rania is the Palestinian queen who is married to the king of Jordan, and she had come out and said that there was no beheading of children, there's no raping of women, this is all lies, blah blah blah. But she's a very influential woman who has a very large social media following, so very important. But this doctor, her name is Quanta Ahmed. She is a female Arab Muslim Israeli. She is a physician senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and she wrote in starking detail some of the most disgusting and horrific crimes that she saw, including
that she personally saw
with her own eyes, including young little girls beheaded and their bodies naked after being raped, and babies beheaded and families, you know, tethered together and decapitated and burned alive. And just on and on. But she goes into detail to make very clear, because she's like, I personally witnessed these as a Arab, as a Muslim woman, as a doctor, and, you know, not tolerating the lies that are being spread. And it's been picking up some speed again, once again, on social media, because I think being far removed again, I think a lot of people have forgotten this. And it's a stark reminder when people say, I am Hamas, I am pro-Hamas. This is what they're actually celebrating and condoning and wanting to see again when they're calling for more intifada and jihad. And, you know, even this week we saw a terrorist inspired by Hamas in Israel go and kill a young mother. She was 9 months pregnant, literally driving on her way to the hospital to give birth, slaughtered her and her baby in cold blood, again, and all in the name of Hamas. And so when we talk about terrorism, I think people, like, terrorism is like, oh, it's a word, blah, blah, blah. No, like, we have to remember the violence, the absolute disgust levels of the how violent these people are and what they have done and what they are talking about continuing to do when we see these people saying this.
A lot of the pro-Palestinian people have turned the world against Israel. We've said it before, Israel is the only nation in the world that has to defend itself for defending itself. But I've always said, it doesn't help itself public relations-wise. And I didn't get a chance to send this to you because I just saw it right before we went on, that apparently they're going to end the food blockade into Gaza. They're going to allow some food to go in there.
Well, we talked about this last week, Mike. There was a blockade up, but even in the blockade, we talked about this last week, in the 6 weeks of the blockade. So first of all, even the United Nations said there was enough food for 2 million people all the way through June, even potentially to August. And then they said, in addition to the 6 weeks, Israel sent in over 388,000 tons of food, an additional during those six weeks. So,
okay,
so when people call
world,
that the blockade,
Lorene, the world doesn't see it like that. Marco Rubio,
the
Secretary of State, called Bibi and said he was concerned about starvation in Gaza.
Now,
Marco Rubio, the
Secretary
of State, Israel, whether there is that food or not, there are, you don't believe anybody's starving in Gaza, which I think is naive. There are some starving people, I believe, and they've been shown on lots of mainstream media. But whether they are starving or not, that's what the world believes. And it gives Israel a black eye. It's dumb. It is just dumb.
I'm going to say this again, Mike. Israel did not block food. Even the United Nations said there's enough food for the population of 2 million people for over 8 months. And even during the six-week blockade of other things coming in, because Israel needed to take control and redo the humanitarian aid of who, which is what they're negotiating with the United States, of who could bring humanitarian aid in so that it would not go to Hamas, that they still brought in 388,000 tons of food in those 6 weeks.
But why would Rubio call Bibi and say, you got to do something to stop this?
So I want to say this. I did not, what I saw was the readout of the Secretary of State's phone call, and the readout from the Secretary of State's phone call that I saw did not mention that. What it did say is that the United States stands completely behind Israel. We've got your back. We're supporting you 100%. That it was the United States and Israel working together on this plan to have non-UN, US-based humanitarian aid forces to begin that process so they could lift the blockade, so that they now have legitimate forces bringing food in that were trustworthy. And so I did not see that in the readout from the State Department. I saw something very different from the readout of the State Department, including the continuation of negotiation with hostages and coming up with some new plans around that. But going back to your point, Mike, about this, again, you blame Israel, but I actually blame the media for not actually reporting accurately, especially when the United Nations says there's enough food for 8 months. And then when Israel, in the midst of the blockade, which was not a food blockade, it was to stop these other aid trucks that they knew were working for Hamas from going in. And so Israel itself supplied 388,000 tons of additional food in the 6 weeks, which according to the UN wasn't even necessary, but they did it anyway. So if the media is going to this small percent that maybe Hamasis are people there, because we know that Hamas is executing people that are anti-Hamas. Maybe they're finding people, or maybe Hamas is staging this, because we know Hamas is like the biggest propagandist there are and can create these false scenes and like, oh,
they do a better job of it than Israel,
right,
unfortunately.
Right. But I want to say this. If the media is going forward and playing the propaganda, which we also know that there's no media that Hamas allows into Gaza unless they toe the Hamas line. And it's just being smarter and wiser about it. And then the question is, the media is just going along with it and not questioning it and saying, well, the UN says there's enough food for 8 months for 2.2 million people. And we're going to walk into the grocery stores. And we've seen videos of grocery stores on TikTok and everywhere else of young Gazans showing how much food there was in their marketplaces and that they're completely stocked. So we want to see those too and tell the world about that story. So you blame Israel. I blame, in a good large part, the media for not telling the full story.
Well, but the thing is, you've got to deal with the reality of what is coming out and what people believe. And Israel, to me, is not trying to do that. And we need all the people on our side as possible. I just think that there is concern, and I know that Rubio was concerned. I can't find the thing here. I'm looking for it, but he did tell Bibi he was concerned about the humanitarian problems in Gaza. There is no question about that, and he said it publicly someplace before the call. So if he's thinking that, okay, then we've got a real problem. The Secretary of State is thinking that. So supposed to be Israeli friendly.
Well, they are Israeli friendly. I mean, when the readout I said, he continued to 100% strong relationship, strong support, and working to come up with plans to get the hostages back and everything else. I mean, let's not forget, this is the same administration that immediately released $5 billion of money and weapons that was being withheld by the prior administration, including all the other weapons that the Biden administration had withheld post October 7th. They also released all of that. So they have gone way out of their way to ensure that Israel has what it needs and has to defend itself and protect itself Does in
it
this
bother
war.
you that Trump didn't stop and see Bibi? Bibi
No,
was on the sidelines when
no,
Trump went on his grift tour through the Middle East to enrich himself.
no, I think this was, first of all, I don't think it was to enrich himself. I think it's to enrich America, the United States of America,
Well, what about
and
all the Trump
American
towers, the Trump
taxpayers.
hotels, and the $400 million airplane that even
Sir,
Republicans are criticizing?
sure. So it's great that you brought this up because, there's an entire business community. You had so many, the United States business community that was there because it was actually a business forum. And you had large number of business people from the UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, also from Qatar, but from the Middle East, from the Abraham Accord countries there, which was very important. And we talked about a $2 trillion of investment going back and forth from America, bringing in American industry and businesses and letting that come back into America
But
and
it's
flow for
also
jobs.
benefiting Trump. It's
Oh,
this
hold
was
on.
the Trump grift
This is,
tour.
oh my God, give me a break, Mike. This is a
Give me a break, a $400
$2
million dollar
trillion.
airplane, hotels and towers
Okay.
in all of the
So
cities
can
that
I
he
ask
visited.
you, so for the hundreds of US American businessmen and women who were there and who are talking about investments back and forth between America and the Middle East and opening up the window of the Middle East, because within a 1,000-mile radius of Saudi Arabia lives 50% of the world's population, and opening that up, because what we do know is that China over the last 10 years has invested $200 billion trying to manipulate and control through finances that area of the world and cut the United States of America out, as well as Russia and Iran, also engaging in that investment along with China. And what he's trying to say is, like, listen, we still remain the dominant force in the world as far as the economy and consumers and everything else. And we're going to open our doors. We've been closed in the past. We notice that MBS and others are trying to change their ways and modernize their societies. And
MBS, the
so we're,
murderer of
oh,
Khashoggi.
all right. Mike, we know that he has done so many things to modernize and to
Oh, yeah,
stop
he has.
Iraq
He's
from Saudi
modernized
Arabia.
it. He's done a wonderful job, but he's a
I know.
murderer. So he's
All
a
right.
murderer, just like the former head of Al Qaeda is now
Or.
running Syria. And this man that everybody labeled as a terrorist, Trump is saying is a great young man now. You don't
Okay,
have a
so
problem with that. I do.
hold on. So MBS, who, by the way, said that the so-called reporter was also a key ringleader in the Muslim Brotherhood. And so just like the United States through CIA and other may take out people, that's what they did. So I don't think that we should be judging that, what
Well,
Saudi
I'm
Arabia did
judging it.
there.
I'm judging
Okay,
it,
but
and so does the
then
majority.
concerning,
So does the majority of the Jewish community, Loreen.
and then concerning Syria, I think this is really important because, again, Syria, don't forget that Russia pretty much was controlling Syria under Assad. And we're trying to keep Russia out, which is very important because Russia has very extreme tensions with Israel right now. And it's trying to reshape that entire area of the world to prevent it from going radicalized so that our friend Israel will not have radicalization all around them. I mean, this is really about shifting the world mindset and how we're looking at the Middle East and investing in these nations that are doing everything they can to shift from post-radicalism into modern societies. And I think we need to be backing on supporting this $2 trillion that's going to support American businesses and industry and open up that universe. And so I have to strongly disagree, and I'm sad that the media is not reporting on that. By the way, on the Qatar plane, which we talked about last week, the fact that Boeing, that President Trump ordered a new plane for the presidential office, over 6+ years ago, and Boeing still can't figure it out and
Make
deliver on the
America
order.
first was his thing. Everything from
Which is
America. Oh,
why
unless I'm going to get a
Boeing,
$400 million.
but the chief commanding officer of the United States of America, whoever the president is, and whoever the next president is, would also have this plane. Is flying in
No,
a plane with 40-year-old.
the plane would go to the Trump Library afterwards. That's
It's flying.
the plan. It's
Hold
supposed to go to
on.
the Trump Library, not to the
Okay.
next president of the United
Who cares?
States.
The president of the United States of America is flying a plane with 40-year-old technology. And what I understand is that the gift is actually to the U.S. Department of Defense, and that the U.S. Department of Defense is working with the Department of Defense of Qatar, and that there and that this plane will be fully scanned and everything else that will go through the DoD directly.
Some of Trump's biggest supporters, Laura Loomer, Joe Rogan, they all are criticizing this deal as grift. Plus, it's not a good deal. The Qatar's been trying to sell it and hasn't been able to. And it would cost, they say, upwards of $1 billion to take apart the plane, put it back together again, and then to make sure there is no spyware on it, which certainly
would be. By the way, maybe we can learn something from them, since apparently Boeing is incapable of delivering on a new Air Force One plane.
I can't speak for Boeing. All I'm saying is this is just horrible grift.
I don't think it's grift. Do I think the optics are bad? Yeah, but Qatar is known for giving planes to other nations. This is what they've done on multiple occasions.
But this is the United States.
I know.
There are laws against giving gifts more than $25 to a president. It's got to be approved by Congress.
But no,
there's the Emoluments Clause, Lorene.
I know. Mike, it's going to Department of Defense. And if it's going to be used as Air Force One, and who knows if it will or will not be, because it does have to go through dramatic inspection. But again, like, the point is let's get our freaking plane. I mean, whoever the next president is, I don't want them flying around on a plane with 40-plus-year-old technology. I mean, that's absurd.
Well, no, the plane, it might be a 40-year-old plane, but the technology has been upgraded with communications and all. No, it has not been.
I know it's been upgraded, but it's still not like the most modern. I mean, that's the problem, right? So I think we do need to like get that taken care of. But there's a lot more to talk about this week. I just want to talk about New York City really quickly, because obviously we had the large Israel Day parade as we were celebrating Israel independence this past week. A lot of things there. Oh my God, Yuval winning second place at Eurovision this weekend. I don't know if anybody watched Yuval. She is a survivor of October 7th. She was in one of the bomb shelter barricades with, you know, dozens of other young Israelis who were at the Nova Music Festival, and they threw a grenade in and started shooting all of them. And she was buried under dead bodies for many, many hours. And she remember calling her father telling her, you need to be quiet, play dead and be quiet. Otherwise they will find you and kill you. And so she played dead for many hours until she was found. And so she came with full force to the Eurovision. I guess it's kind of the best example would be American Idol, but it's a big deal. Like, all the European countries compete. Israel did win
a couple years ago.
It was in Basel, Switzerland. And she stood on the same balcony at Theodor Herzl, proclaiming Israeli independence once again. But she came in second place. She didn't win the whole thing, but the fact that she came in second place and she had the Israeli flag.
Well, because there are some people who didn't even want to let her perform.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the protesters were out there. You got to kick her out, blah, 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 the whole thing. But just such a proud performance. And it was just beautiful. And you can watch a song. Her performance is available on social media everywhere.
Yeah, and it is great. Yeah, I watched it. That really is a terrific performance.
It was. But this week also was Israeli independence celebration. They had the big parade in New York City. Eric Adams, he worked very closely to ensure complete increase in protection over those who'll be participating in festivities. And the other thing that Eric Adams is, he's announced a new mask ban in the city of New York.
I have to disagree with that, Lorene. I have a friend who is immune compromised, and he flew on a plane this weekend. And when he's out in public events, he wears a mask because he's immune compromised.
That's an exception, Mike. That's an exception. What they're looking for are protesters and people engaging in protests.
I understand.
You know why the mask ban originally existed, right? Because it exists in most states, actually. There is actually a mask ban on the books in many states.
Right.
And the reason was
before
because
COVID.
Because of the KKK. Because of the
right.
KKK.
Right. No, I understand that.
And what he's saying is, and what he did, Mike, was say, we're going to bring that back. We're bringing that back in New York City, because what we've seen is not just all these violent pro-terrorist supporters that have been destroying public property and attacking Jews and everybody else, mass, and we can't get their faces. We don't know who they are. We can't arrest them. It's emboldening them. But we also see other just criminals doing the same thing now. And he's like, that's it, mask ban. And look, Mike, if your friend is wearing an N95 mask because they're sick, they're immune, and he's explained that to the police officer, he's not involved in a protest or some kind of criminal event. it's a non-issue. However,
I'm afraid they'll overstep it just the way ICE has overstepped its arrest.
New York City is not doing that. Give me a break. But New York City needs to do something, and I'm very proud of them doing that. I want to
I disagree with it. I just don't think it's wise, but it's nothing I would go to battle over. But like I think about my friend. Anyhow, listen.
I want to talk about the candidate really quickly. This is the other important thing I want to say this. So Zohran Mamdani, which, you know, we've been talking about for a couple of weeks now, he is running as a Democrat, but he is not a Democrat. He is a true radical socialist, part of the DSA of America.
He's running for mayor of New York City.
Of New York City. And this guy who there's countless videos of him. He is rabidly anti-Israel, anti-Semitic. He's accused Israel of genocide and everything else. And all these new videos have come out from him over the last several years, of him praising the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, of protesting Israel, of attacking Jews. Like, there's all these videos now, which is really important. I just want to remind New Yorkers, because I feel like people are
paying
attention.
I think he is a fringe candidate, Laureen. I don't think he has
He actually has a lot of support. I mean, he's actually got a large base, because he's got the AOC base, you know, the former vice president's husband. His daughter has come out publicly endorsing and supporting him, and she's very pro Hamas, pro Palestinian, whatever, you know. But I like, we need to be paying really close attention and not take it for granted, and ensure that New York Jews are voting and not falling for it and not voting for this man.
The Jewish vote. Okay, let's get to our guest, Avi Mohammed, who was in town last week at the Glazer JCC. He is an Israeli intelligence expert. His area of expertise that he worked for the Israeli government was on Arab countries. He speaks fluent, obviously, Hebrew, because he's from Israel, but also fluent Arabic, and understands the whole Arab situation probably better than anybody I have heard speak before. And one of the things he said in the speech the other day that blew me away is that October 7th could have been worse, because Hezbollah and Iran and Hamas were trying to hatch a plan where they would all invade at the same time. It's really scary. Avi Mohammed is in the nonpartisan Inside the Middle East organization, ITME.org, and here's part one.
Well, I was, to be more accurate, I was talking about the concept of what was known as the unifying of the arenas. This concept actually was a very significant component in the master plan of this axis, this radical axis, the axis of resistance. The concept of unifying of the arenas has been a very significant component in their blueprint to eliminate Israel. And the concept of unifying of the arenas actually portrayed a situation where the different factors of this axis of resistance, like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iraqi and Afghan and Shiite and Pakistani Shiite militias that used to be up until recently present in Syria, how all those Iranian-backed factors were supposed to actually act as one, joining together as one, and attacking Israel from all directions. And in fact, that was the idea beyond the concept of the unifying of the arenas, that master plan, that in the end of the day was not executed the way Hamas thought it's going to be executed. Hamas was under the impression that on October 7th, he was under the impression that the day of unifying of the arenas has come. And Hamas' impression was not baseless, because in the months before the attack, there were meetings of the leaders of the Axis of Resistance, Hezbollah and others, with Hamas, including meeting in Iran. And Hamas heard from his colleagues to the Axis of Resistance that they are willing, ready, and able to move together. And so Hamas launched October 7th under the assumption that the day has come, but that was not what exactly happened following that on the ground.
And you said Hamas was surprised and upset that the other people didn't invade at the same point.
Yes, that is correct. I mean, as I said before, Hamas was under the impression that, you know, all other members of the Axis of Resistance will join in full capacity. It didn't happen. And so, quite shortly after October 7th, the leaders of Hamas rushed both to Hezbollah in Lebanon and also to Iran. They met with the supreme leader of Iran. They met with the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and they urged them to join into the war. Because Hamas was under the impression that they are going to join in full capacity. It didn't happen, and the answer that Hamas got from both Iran and Hezbollah was that, in fact, that they are not going to join full capacity to this war that Hamas launched on October 7th. Obviously, Hamas was very disappointed, and you know, and in the Arab world, I should mention, as part of the criticism on Hamas, a criticism that has been there already way before October 7th, because of the destruction that Hamas inflicted upon Gaza Strip, particularly after Hamas took over Gaza Strip in 2007 forcefully by eliminating the rule of the Palestinian Authority. The criticism in the Arab world, and including the Palestinians on Hamas, as you can understand, mounted and boosted following October 7 because of the catastrophic ramification of Hamas' decision to launch war on Israel on October 7, the catastrophic ramification for Gaza people in, as well. And Hamas is under mounting criticism, and one of the major expression of that criticism in the Arab world is actually they basically says to Hamas, they say, look, you trusted your colleagues to the Axis of Resistance, Hezbollah and Iran and others, that they will join in full capacity, but they basically have betrayed you. They basically left you alone, and they basically left you and the people of Gaza to pay the price of your decision to attack Israel on October 7th. So it should be also be clear that as part of the criticism on Hamas, that component exists as well.
Let's turn to Gaza. Netanyahu says he'd like to clear Hamas out of Gaza and make it so they're never there. You said that Hamas is not going to go away, correct?
Correct.
So what happens?
Look, Hamas was born in Gaza Strip. Hamas is from Gaza Strip. This is a very significant point to emphasize. Because in the end of the day, Hamas has a power base in Gaza Strip. We should remember that Hamas acted Gaza Strip as a governing power, meaning he had a military forces of some 30,000-40,000 militants. He legislated laws. He monitored the trade and economy. He set the curriculum in schools and universities in Gaza Strip. The whole system in Gaza Strip, in the end of the day, Hamas ruled that system, and it's part of that system. And the meaning of that is that we have to remember that many people in Gaza Strip benefit from Hamas rule economically. We are talking about people that were paid for salaries or had commission for participating in the commercial activity in Gaza Strip and so on and so on. And so Hamas is from Gaza Strip, and it's entrenched in the fabric of Gaza Strip. That being said, there are many people in Gaza Strip who don't like Hamas because it is a brutal, oppressive power that more than once has been oppressively shutting down any kind of like opposition or outcry of the people of Gaza. But as I said, now it is part of the people of Gaza, and therefore talking about eliminating Hamas is totally irrelevant. And so I always said all along the way that the objective should be at the end of the day to neutralize as much as possible Hamas' ability to continue and to dictate the radical agenda as it was unfortunately able to do for the last 40 years. Because when you look at the trajectory of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the last 40 years, you see that it has been enormously escalating. And the major perpetuators of that escalation was this whole axis of resistance backed by Iran and Qatar. And Hamas, as I mentioned before, is a very significant component in this axis.
One of the things that you said that gave me goosebumps, actually, was toward the end of your speech. You said it's going to take decades, not decade, but decades, to bring any type of peace in that area. That, like I say, it gave me goosebumps. It's not a quick solution.
No, there is no magic wand, and I think that the better we will adopt a realistic outlook of a very complex reality, the best. The sooner we do that, the better. I mean, look, it's one of the things that I think that I probably said in this lecture that I gave is that, when you look at the trajectory of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the last 40 years, as I mentioned before, it has enormously escalated. However, parallel to that, when you look at the major discussion in the Western circles vis-a-vis the conflict, interesting enough, the discussion in the Western circles focused almost obsessively with the issue of two-state solution and peace. In other words, the discussion in the Western circles was very much detached from the reality on the ground. And I think that one of the major challenges is that, and I said it all in my speech, and I explained that, it's not about a game of blame. I found both Israeli Palestinians responsible for the gloomy situation, but basically I said that the issue of two-state solution was never really relevant, and this is not a political opinion, it's a professional observation. It was never relevant because the sides, meaning Israel and the Palestinians, were unable to go through the painful process of making significant concessions and compromises that are conditioned for any kind of viable two-state solution. You can't have a viable two-state solution without making those concessions within both Israelis as well as Palestinians. So such process didn't really take place neither within Israelis nor Palestinians. And on top of that, we have witnessed a constant escalation. And that was before October 7th, let alone following October 7th. So I think that adopting a realistic approach towards the issue requires understanding that we are looking at a very long and convoluted process. There is no shortcut here. We are talking about the need of people at the end of the day to be able to come over generations of hostilities and agony and death, and to be really able to set a new course where, in the end of the day, the two people could live one next to the other as good neighbors. And this is long and convoluted process. It involves many moving parts, so to speak. And I think the most significant one, in the end of the day, has to do, as I said, in the context of the inner discussion within both Israelis as well as Palestinians regarding their narratives, their core narratives and their ethos, national ethos, what are they willing and able to compromise on, what are the things that they cannot, and what does it mean in the context of trying to achieve some sort of like an arrangement, I don't even say agreement or a peace agreement, but that will enable them just to move on to the next, what I call scaffold, because it's a process that has to be gradual and has to run its course.
Can it happen under the Netanyahu regime?
Now, he was talking to me as he was driving from New Orleans to Baltimore. He is on a 10-month tour, mainly trying to talk to young Jewish students to try to rekindle their love for Israel, because it has dissipated among young people. And since October 7th, a new survey has shown that Israel has lost a lot of support of American Jews, which just is mind-boggling to me.
I mean, I can't think of a more important time to get behind our land and our people. But I want to just comment on a couple of things, because, you know, what he's talking about, Mike, just really quickly, two things on that this week. You know,
okay, because we got to take a break.
Yeah, as we remember, you know, 1948, after we declared independence, the five surrounding Arab nations, which had populations that exceeded ours by like 1,000%, they surrounded and attacked Israel to destroy us, to finish the ethnic cleansing and the genocide that Hitler had started. Because Israel was the last place that we remained in the Middle East. We had been ethnically cleansed from everywhere else. And that's where they were just coming to finish the job. And Israel miraculously survived and won that battle against five Arab nations. And that's what they were trying to repeat, you know. But along
exactly.
those lines, I wanna say, so these people call it their Nakba Day, the day of disaster, right? The day that they lost to the Jews. They call it their great Nakba. And so Congressman Rashida Tlaib has proposed a resolution in order for the United States government to recognize the Nakba, the Palestinians, the day of their disaster. No. It was a day of your defeat. You were a military of five nations that came to ethnically cleanse and actually perpetrate genocide on the remaining Jews in the Middle East. And miraculously, we survived and you lost. No, we are not going to recognize your Nakba. You lost, period. And that's right. The way that works. And so I just want to put that out there, because it's so disgusting to me that she would even say, oh, the Nakba. Like, when people mention Nakba, you need to know what they're referring to.
Right.
That's
Listen,
what
we
they
got,
mean.
Laureen, we got to take a break. We're going to come back with part two of Ami Melamed. And we'll do that after we take this break. This is The Third Opinion. We'll get to part two of Avi Melamed's interview in just a moment. But have you checked out our webpage, where you can find out more about our hosts, as well as listen to previous editions of the Third Opinion podcast? And don't forget, you can get the Third Opinion wherever you download your podcasts. And now, back to the Third Opinion and part two of that interview. Welcome back to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW in the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Lorena Tampa.
Okay, we heard Avi Melamed in the first half of the show. And when I was talking to him, and he talked about this in the speech that I heard, I asked him, can there be peace with Bibi as the Prime Minister of Israel? You might be surprised by his answer.
I don't agree with him.
No, it cannot happen under the Netanyahu regime, and it cannot happen as long as Hamas is continuing to dictate the inner Palestinian agenda. So you got on both sides, you got a good example of like how political powers, the Israeli side as well as on the Palestinian side, are actually are unable to basically lead the people to a positive. And as long as there is no substantial change in the inner discussion within the sides, in the sense of the willingness to make significant compromises and concessions, it will be unrealistic to expect that it will result in a different political powers that will have the ability to shape a different trajectory, different than the one that unfortunately has been shaped thus far. predominantly, unfortunately, very negative.
The charges that there's a famine in Gaza. Now, Israel says that it's provided enough food for 5 or 6 months before the blockade. I keep seeing stories on television and in the newspaper that everybody is starving in Gaza. Can you cut through that and give us the true story? What is really happening in terms of that and with the blockade?
Look, I don't have data that specifies, you know, amount of commodities, the size, the nature of commodities, and so on and so on. But I put it this way. I think that at least based upon, since I am fluent in Arabic and I am extracting almost all of my information from Arab sources, and since I am also able to have a direct access to information from Gaza Strip, particularly through the social media. My impression is that apparently there are pockets of stress in Gaza in some areas, particularly the areas where there has been fight or areas where people were had to evacuate from. On the other hand, I think that in the major urban areas of Gaza Strip, again, that is based upon visual content that I watched on social media or platforms of social media from Gaza Strip that published by Palestinians. I didn't see expression of famine. I actually saw what seems to be like a very vibrant commercial activities. So, again, I mean, I'm aware of the reports about the famine in Gaza Strip. I don't know to say exactly if it is correct or not. I didn't see in all of my sources and all information, again, that I'm extracting directly from Gaza Strip. I'm not dependent upon Western other mediators, and I have the access to the information. I think that more than once there has been a lot of examples of information coming from Gaza Strip allegedly presenting some sort of situation that was not really accurately describing the reality. And so I think that for Western audience, it's a challenge because Western audience mostly does not master the Arabic and obviously cannot extract information from Arab sources. It is dependent upon mediated information. That information is mediated either by social media or by media, traditional media, or by factors that have a political agenda. And so for Western audience, I think it's very challenging to assess or evaluate what is exactly the reality. Obviously, you know, in the age of social media and let alone AI, it's very easy to create some sort of an impression that is very much emotionally based messaging, sort of speaking. But we have to be, I think, more, you know, a little bit more cautious in the way we view information coming from wherever it comes from, and to apply some sort of like more critical thinking to try to understand better a reality. I think that aspect is to a large extent absent in the way that Westerns are consuming information, particularly like in the context of the story of what's going on.
It seems to me
that Israel is losing the public relations war with the West. I mean, it's the only country in the world that has to defend itself for defending itself, but it doesn't help itself sometimes, I think, like when it cut off the electricity, whether that was a good military thing or not. With worldwide opinion, I just worry that Israel is not doing a good public relations job. Geez, we were attacked, and people are attacking us verbally in the West now.
Yes, look, you portrayed indeed a very challenging situation. I think that it's one part of that, as actually what you said, Israel is facing a growing problem of its PR and image. One part is definitely has to do with the Israeli PR or the Israeli public diplomacy and whatever, but you know, I don't want to get to that because there are different organizations and people that are trying to do whatever they can. But I think that there is a very significant component of these challenges that when you look at the way Westerns are consuming information, you could very clearly see that for the last at least generation, there has been a very challenging process in terms of the education or the level of education, in the sense that in centers of influence in the West, I'm talking about intellectual or academia or media or cultural circles, looking at reality became more and more something that has been subscribed to an emotional mindset and subscribe to theories that actually centers around this whole thing of racism and imperialism and the blame of the West and white supremacy and all kind of things that resulted in the end of the day a very challenging phenomenon in the Western circles of education and discussion, because to a large extent the dominant factor in the whole process of consuming information and understanding of reality, the dominant factor has become an emotional mindset. And in the age of the social media, it has, of course, been significantly boosted because, you know, people are consuming the information from a five words message or from a visual, whether it's inaccurate or processed or manipulated, it doesn't matter. And so you find that in such a mindset, it is not wondering. It's not wonder that messages that basically portray Israel as the ultimate evil, even though of course the reality is by far not that, those messages have been quite easily endorsed by those circles in the West that for their own need, emotionally need, they basically easily adopted that outlook that basically presents Israel as the ultimate evil and the Palestinians as the ultimate victims. None of those, of course, is really an accurate reflection of the reality. I would say that, you know, I said something like, you know, one major thing that clearly is guiding the Western circles who are very vocally, and I'm talking about the Western, I'm not talking about the Arab factors within the Western circles, I'm talking about the Western circles themselves. It's very clear that they are guided by a mindset that says that they have no doubt that by taking a very harsh stand against Israel, portraying Israel as the evil and the Palestinians as the ultimate victims, I have no doubt that in their mind they are standing on the right side of history. In their mind. Mm. But here is what I want to say in that regard. In order to stand on the right side of history, you need to know what history is. And I have more than a suspicion that the level of knowledge of many of those people regarding the history is very, very not sufficient, let's put it this way, to be prolonged. And so I would basically say to these people, look, I understand that you are maybe genuinely motivated by the belief that you, by taking this very vocal anti-Israel position, you have no doubt that you position yourself on the right side of history. You should, however, consider the possibility that because you don't know the history, you may, ironically speaking, putting yourself in the totally wrong side.
Okay, so Lorene doesn't agree that there can't be peace without Bibi. He thinks there can't be peace with Hamas or with Bibi, and I don't doubt it. I mean, here's the deal, Lorene. If there is peace, Bibi will lose his job and maybe go to jail.
First of all, he's not going to jail. Like all these stupid things are all these cases against him, like one after another, and they get dropped because they're just dumb. But concerning Netanyahu, I mean. You know, first of all, like right now, he and Witkoff are working on a new hostage negotiation deal, which would release all hostages, completely dismantle Hamas, and disarm Gaza forever. And you know, you
Hamas
and I talked
is
about
not
going
to go away, Lorene.
They're talking about exiling Hamas and removing them, and I think that's why Israel is now engaging open Operation Gideon's Chariots, which is why they went back in. And by the way, going back in. Forcefully to take on the one remaining cell of Hamas that has not been dismantled, it has actually forced Hamas to come back to the negotiating table, and that's exactly what they want. And this is what everybody's been talking about. You need to have complete disarmament and removal of them, and complete disarmament of Gaza. Period. And I think once you can do that and accomplish that, and you and I know it's still going to take decades. It has nothing to do with Benjamin Netanyahu or others. It will take decades because it's not just because it's the mindset. You have people who have been so radicalized for generations now. You have to like re-educate, re-inform. I hate using the word re-educate. It's just de-radicalize. Just
everybody
who is
in Gaza and their children will hate Israel for the rest of their lives, even though Hamas started everything October 7th,
and that's the other part, Mike. I mean, I don't know if you saw that, but the Wall Street Journal did a big expose this week. They had uncovered some records that Hamas had hidden in Gaza that pretty much confirmed what we knew, that Hamas did what they did on October 7th to derail
Saudi Arabia
from joining the Abraham Accords. Because they saw that it was imminent and that it would be happening. And so they're like, no, we have to do everything we can to stop this. And, they brought that onto themselves now. So this remains a major issue. But I think the other thing, Mike, that was really important this week, you know, Witkoff, again, as the negotiations continue with Iran, Witkoff has said, we have a red line, not even 1% of uranium enrichment allowed.
And there are some that's saying it's going to be JCPOA light. That it's going to, they're going to do the same thing that Trump threw out before, and it's moving toward.
I don't think
like
so, because under the JCPOA, they were allowed to do uranium enrichment, and they're saying, and they repeated it again this week several times.
I know, but they're 1%. Both Iran and the United States are desperate to do a deal, and a lot of people.
Well,
even
Iran
those,
is more desperate than we are. We're not that desperate. I think Iran is way more desperate than we are. But and the other cool story this week, Mossad. The Mossad goes into Syria and they recovered a treasure trove of Eli Cohn's records, documents.
Okay,
photos.
Eli Cohn was a true hero. Explain who Eli Cohn was.
Oh my God. So he was a Mossad agent who managed to infiltrate Syria at the highest levels of the government and of the monarchy at the time. He was in Syria and he would. And so, like, when Syrian forces would attack Israel, like, he was operating, letting the Israelis know where the Syrian forces were. He had this one really cool thing that he did, and he convinced that he gifted the Syrian army these large eucalyptus trees, which were not native to the Golan or Israel. And they would plant them where he's like, plant them where the soldiers are, so they'll have shade, blah, blah, blah. You know, he has all these gifts of these trees. And so that's how the Israelis knew where they were.
He was finally caught and executed, but he was a true hero who lived for years within Syrian community. But Laureen, you hear that music? We are out of time. Thanks for being with us. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Laureen in Tampa.
Bye. That's our show for this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. And thanks for listening.